Yes.
I have a question. Partly in reflection to the part that you talked about the radiance of the flower.
Yeah.
I've, for the past couple of days, been across the street, and in the courtyard they have many roses.
Uh-huh.
And I've quite often enjoyed looking at them, whether the bloom is full or haven't opened or has bloomed and is not there. And so, in doing so, I began to think, why do we cultivate beauty?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because of the ephemerality of the flower? Does the beauty come from the fact that it's so quickly dissipating? Does it come from the expectation of a bud which at any moment might burst?
Yeah.
Or is it the cycle and intending to the flowers? Does the beauty arise from contemplating that cycle?
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious about what you might offer with that.
Well, what comes to mind is all of the above. Yeah, and that all of it is aspects of beauty, but I think it's paying attention to how beauty in its different forms or at different manifestations, how it does affect us. But then also one of the ways that beauty is how do we hold it? Because appreciating it is one thing, but then grasping after it, searching for it all the time, having to have it, it crushes it. So there's an idiom in the scriptural language that the Buddha uses as a distillation of all of the teachings, and it's in the scriptural language, sabbe dhamma nalana binivesaya. So nothing whatsoever should be clung to. So, and that's how you can be happy. That's how you can be peaceful. So that, in that sense of, and it's not that one dismisses, that's not a dismissal of beauty, or a dismissal of happiness, but it's sort of, they're acknowledging it and being able to let it be something that is impermanent, that is built up out of conditions, that may or may not be there, then you're happy. I had the good fortune to spend time with good teachers, and many here have had time to be with Master Hua, who's another great teacher, and they had a real enjoyment of the world, not in a chasing after it, but in just, the world is like this, and isn't that wonderful? And isn't it weird? I think one of the things, I recently had, my mother came to visit the monastery in Baigiri in April, and And she said, she told me that she was starting to clear out all her stuff. And I mean, she's going to be 100, so it's about time. So but one of the things that she had saved was all the letters I wrote from when I first went off traveling, and then when I got to the monastery, and I had no idea. And anyway, there's a whole box that got back to the monastery. Debbie brought it back, and but I can't bring myself to read it. But there was one letter that I did write where I was describing, because I was trying to tell my parents about Ajahn Chah's five-year plan. It was written in 1976, so it was like my second year as a monk. And I was trying to break them into the reality that I was going to be there much longer than I originally said. That Ajahn Chah had commit to 5 years to begin with. But when I was telling my parents about that, then I was saying one of the things that really inspires me or draws me to do that is just having watched Ajahn Chah for the past couple of years and just seeing how unshakable he is in the midst of all of the things that are happening around him, and how warm and compassionate his response to the people around, whether it's the monastics or the lay community. And so if I could get a little bit of that, that'd be great. So it's there's not a pushing away of, say, happiness or beauty, but there's really, I mean, we talk about a transcendent level. It's not otherworldly. It's really here, but it's not entangled. That's very beautiful. Did I get what?
Did you get a little bit? And what's it like?
Well, that's you figure that out. I'm hanging out.
Yes.
I'm hanging out doing this for this is my 50th year as a monk. So yeah. I see some value in it. Yes.
Is there a plan to publish the letters?
There actually is a bunch of people who are transcribing them. Debbie's on the case, and there's some of you might know Kovilo, who's Ajahn Kovilo. And Nisabo and a few other Thai people. They want to do a biography, and so they're working on it, and the letters are going to form a part of that. We'll see.
I like to read it.
I'm going to wait for the movie.
Yes.
So
I was staying with some friends in Avagiri a couple weeks ago. And one thing I noticed was that some of the monks use social media, and not too much, of course, they have a balance, but as a youngster, I use a lot of social media. And you kind of grew up, I'm sure, like in the time where there was not really. So what's your view on, you know, like how it's affecting our mind?
Personally, I think it's really toxic. And actually, like, there, as a monk at Abhayagarh, member of the community at Abhayagiri, if one's going to, you have to give up any social media accounts. And then, so if somebody is, you know, there as a layperson and they're there for a while and they want to commit to training, then one of the first things they would be asked about is, okay, your social media account, you've got to go. There's one monk who has been experimenting with doing like videos, and but he's not living there as a resident. Yes.
I have a question on the social media following question, because I think the name to me, social media, first is social. But I feel that a lot of people, they are disconnected with the reality world. They don't have a place of social. And then they withdraw themselves and go on the internet. So I think the fundamental problem is people's loneliness in this real world. And do you have any comments on how to connect with people in the real world so there can be a replacement of social media?
Yes. I mean, it is. It's really important because one of the, whenever the Buddha talks about the conditions that are suitable for, say, a arising of right view or arising of wisdom and understanding, one of the first things is having good friendships. Kalyan Mitta is a really important foundation for developing our spiritual path. So the other aspect tends to be like wise reflection or considered attention. And so both an external and internal component are important, and certainly that, yeah, developing skillful social relationships are really helpful. That said, I mean, one of the things that, of course, Abhayagiri does, or most of the kind of monasteries and Dhamma centers that do have, say, websites or YouTube channels, and it's helpful to connect with. Use it as a means of connecting to other human beings, and to human beings who are living maybe a hopefully exemplary life. So it helps to inspire us or to aspire to something that is quite useful. So again, it's not something, you know, and certainly, you know, I think during the time of the pandemic, it was a lifeline for a lot of people, being able to. One of the things we did at Abhayagiri, when we built our new meditation hall, we had made sure there's a good sound system and a good camera system for. And then, but it wasn't until the pandemic that we realized, oh, we can just turn this thing on anytime. And so, you know, people can join us for meditation, they can join us for chanting, they can, and we, so we did. And as well as the, like, we still do, of course, the, now it's all tapered off, but the, you know, Saturday night pujas, meditation, Dhamma talk, and then the lunar observance nights, so people can join from afar, and people usually do. So it does give a connection to, say, like a spiritual community. And in many places. So it's, again, it's skillful choices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, during the pandemic, I'm not really into the social media.
Yeah.
But these 2 years, the past 2 years, yeah, I really communicate with my family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot.
Yeah.
And and before the pandemic, no, I didn't have very good communication with them.
And
now it's still this communication.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
We communicate more and more and more.
Yeah.
And we have meetings and we have parties on online than ever.
Yeah.
And it's still on all this.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's the thing, there's never any real black and white.
Yeah.
And it's how do you use things? How do you derive benefit from it? How do you apply wisdom and discernment to everything?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Yeah, great. It's a good example.
What's the feeling of wearing the same color for
50
years?
What was that?
What's the feeling of wearing the same color for 50 years?
Yeah, it's not a complicated feeling. Less choice is really good. That's just sort of antithetical to America.
Really? I have a question that's kind of related to colors. So the five senses,
mm-hmm.
seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Normally, at least from my understanding, it's not good to indulge.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a way to make that help with your cultivation? Become a skillful assistant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because that's as I was saying, there's external factors and internal factors.
Mm-hmm.
And the internal factor of, say, like, in the scriptural language, yoni soul manasikara, wise attention, so that you're paying attention to your external experience. You're bringing it in. Also, one of the qualities that when we chant on the qualities of the Buddha's teachings of the Dhamma, one of the qualities in Pali anyway is open aiko, which means leading inwards. So you're taking your external experience and drawing it into the heart, reflecting on it, paying attention, discerning more clearly what's useful, what's not useful, what's beneficial, what's not beneficial, what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. And so that the senses are just that. I mean, they're the kind of the raw data of our world. That's when the Buddha is asked, the world, what is the world? The eye is the world, the ear is the world, the nose is the world, the tongue is the world, the body is the world, the mind itself is the world. Or in another place where the Buddha is, that whereby one perceives the world and conceives of the world, that is the world. So that paying attention to the senses and recognizing, yeah, this can go both ways.
Follow-up question on that.
Yeah.
And of course, we crave happiness through the senses.
Yeah.
And it's understandable, you know, attaching to a certain kind of happiness through the senses not helpful for cultivation, but there's also the emphasis on joy in
yeah.
the Buddha's teaching.
Yeah.
So there should be a balance in where to find that.
Well, one of the things I think that's really helpful to reflect on is that, say, like in the fundamental structure of the Four Noble Truths, dukkha, origin of dukkha, cessation of dukkha,
mm-hmm.
the ending of dukkha, path leading to cessation of dukkha, all of the elements of the path are a source of happiness and well-being. Every aspect of, you know, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, those are all sources of happiness and well-being. So it's like learning how to make those skillful choices.
Sorry, another follow-up. But what about the joy that comes from enjoying the central things, like, you know, music? We have a lot of musicians here this
yeah.
week. Painting, beautiful painting.
Mm-hmm.
Smell of the scents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, water, touch of the water, you know, that kind of...
Well, I mean, it's quite natural. I mean, we prefer it. If you chase after it,
mm.
it's a problem.
Mm.
If you expect it,
mm.
then you start measuring it. And as soon as you start expecting it, it never quite measures up to how you thought it was going to be or how you wanted it to be.
Mm.
So it's just, yeah, happiness and joy are to be paid attention to a certain degree. Cultivated, but it's how we cultivate it. When it comes through, say, like a non-clinging or non-grasping, a non-expectation, then there's some space around it to actually satisfy, rather than complicate and confuse. Okay, wrap it up for this evening. Good to see everybody.
Mm-hmm.